From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukraine's president accuses Russia of open aggression. Pakistan security clears protesters from the state television station, and we hear how blind bicyclists enjoy the freedom that comes on wheels. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko is accusing Russia of open aggression as his military ordered the retreat of troops fighting a Russian tank in eastern Ukraine. The Ukrainian presidential website quoted Mr. Poroshenko as saying direct open aggression against Ukraine from a neighboring state has now begun, fundamentally changing the situation in the conflict zone in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine National Security and Defense Council spokesman Andrei Lysenko said Ukrainian soldiers were ordered to retreat from the airport near the rebel stronghold city of Luhansk. He claimed the troops had been fired on by Russian armed forces, judging by the precision of the strikes. Lysenko said 7 Ukrainian troops had been killed and 25 wounded in fighting during the previous 24 hours. NATO estimates there are at least 1,000 Russian troops in Ukraine, and EU leaders have demanded Russia immediately withdraw its forces. Russia has repeatedly denied it has any troops in Ukraine. Well, on Sunday, Russian President Vladimir Putin called for substantive talks on statehood for southeastern Ukraine. That's a change from previous calls for granting Russian-speaking people in eastern Ukraine greater autonomy or federalization. European analyst Leslie Templeman-Holmes of Australia's University of Melbourne says the crisis in Ukraine may be part of Mr. Putin's new Russia effort.
It's in line with what he's done in other parts of the former Soviet Union. Georgia is one case, Moldova is another, and now clearly he wants to extend Russian influence into eastern Ukraine. And the way he's going to try and do it now, apparently, is to encourage the development of an independent state there. As he so often is, it's in one sense a clever move, because he's not actually saying that eastern Ukraine should be incorporated into Russia, but rather he wants a discussion, at least, of an East Ukrainian state, which, of course, would be oriented towards Moscow.
Ukraine said that the country is on the brink of full-scale war with Moscow, and that there may be as many as 1,000 Russian regular troops in Ukraine.
There are people going around with unmarked uniforms in unmarked tanks that have clearly been recently painted. The Russian government continues to deny their involvement, but I don't think it takes a terribly insightful person to realize that the rebels couldn't be doing all this just on their own. They need both materiel and they need skills and instruction from professional soldiers.
President Obama is going to go to Estonia this week. What message do you expect him to bring about Ukraine?
Simply being in a former Soviet state is itself a message. The Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland, those four countries in particular, are very, very nervous about Russian expansionism. The three Baltic states and Poland, of course, are members of NATO, and so they can call on NATO to defend them. But the fact that Rasmussen, the head of NATO, has said that there will be a strengthening of NATO within the Baltic states, and the fact that President Obama is going to one of them, this sends a clear message to Russia that the West will not just sit back. But having said that, we'll have to wait and see whether President Obama continues with insisting that this is not a Russian invasion. The words like incursion are, in my opinion, a little soft for what's happening.
Are Western sanctions biting into Russia?
They are, but it depends whether the Russian population is prepared to put up with it. I think one of the problems dealing with Russia is that Westerners, we tend to work on rationality assumptions, things like economic interest. You know, it's the economy is stupid. That's our way of thinking. And if we do, then we're misunderstanding a typical Russian way of looking at it, which is that there are emotions and nationalism that are also important. But there will come a point, and fairly soon, I think, where Russians will find that their standard of living, their costs are going up, their standard of living is going down, And if this continues, if the sanctions continue to bite and if they're intensified, as the EU and the US have said might happen at the end of this week, I think it won't be too long before Russians start wondering whether all this expansionism really is in their vested interest.
Leslie Templeman Holmes of the University of Melbourne. On U.S. television Sunday, the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, said Mr. Putin enjoys broad public support in Russia over his Ukraine policy.
I think this is deeply personal with him. I really do. And I think he's calling the shots himself. And he's enjoying intensely high favorability in his country. People say, well, just wait till the sanctions bite and the economy slips. I don't think so. I think if Russians follow him, and up to date they are following him, the Russians are very brave and very long-suffering, and they will tough out any economic difficulty.
Senator Dianne Feinstein and U.S. Congressman Mike Rogers, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, told a U.S. television audience Sunday the Ukrainians should get the logistics, arms, intelligence, and training assistance that they've been calling for. Pakistani security forces have cleared hundreds of anti-government protesters from the state television station after the demonstrators seized the building and briefly took the channel off the air. The protesters, who are demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, stormed today into Pakistani television, which carried live coverage of the demonstrators in its offices in the capital, Islamabad. Later in the day, police fired tear gas as the demonstrators, armed with wooden clubs, tried to reach the Prime Minister's residence. At a television station, the opposition leader, cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan, told the demonstrators that Mr. Sharif has no moral standing to continue to lead Pakistan. He said, "We are saying to Nawaz Sharif that he should now step down because today people will come out all over Pakistan against him and there will be losses to the Pakistani people and will be losses to people's property all because of you and you have no moral ground to continue as prime minister." The demonstrators have been protesting for several weeks, but Khan is vowing not to call off the anti-government protests until the prime minister resigns. Khan urged supporters in Islamabad Sunday night to confront the police and show resolve against what he calls its illegal crackdown on peaceful demonstrators. Pakistan's powerful military held an unprecedented Sunday meeting of its top commanders, who say the government should immediately end the standoff peacefully. Army Chief General Rahil Sharif warns that further use of force will only aggravate the unrest. Thousands of protesters have been camped out in Islamabad. The opposition charges Mr. Sharif with massive fraud in last year's election. International observers have said the vote was largely free and fair. After boycotting a United Nations-supervised audit of all votes from June's disputed runoff, Afghan presidential hopeful Abdullah Abdullah has now threatened to pull out from the entire political process if his demands are not met in 24 hours. Controversy surrounding Afghanistan's presidential election are undermining hopes for a smooth political transition in the war-ravaged nation. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
The Afghan Independent Election Commission and UN officials say that weeks of auditing ballot boxes from the presidential runoff is near completion. Last week, when they began the long-awaited process of validating or invalidating suspicious boxes, Abdullah Abdullah pulled his observers, saying his demands for tightening the criteria were not met. At the request of UN officials, rival presidential candidate Ashraf Ghani also withdrew his observers to ensure the integrity of the internationally monitored vote scrutiny and its outcome. Political negotiations between Ghani's and Abdullah's teams continued for devising a framework needed to establish a so-called national unity government after the audit results are announced. But on Monday, a spokesman for former Foreign Minister Abdullah said those talks have collapsed, blaming the other side for the failure. Spokesman Muslim Sadat tells VOA that despite public pledges, the Ghani campaign has gone back on its commitment to form a national unity government.
They kept wasting the time and people are very tired and exhausted of the process. Therefore, we have set a deadline for tomorrow. which means in 24 hours, if they did not came and agreed with the with our requests and demands, both on the political and technical side, we will withdraw from the process. And any result coming out of this illegal, illegitimate process will not be acceptable for one team.
Sadat said Abdullah will hold a news conference on Tuesday to explain how and what went wrong with both the political talks and technical process. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry brokered the deal between Ghani and Abdullah in early August to prevent a political crisis and form a national unity government. Washington intervened because Abdullah, who topped the first round of presidential voting in April, rejected the June runoff preliminary results that put Ghani well ahead of him, alleging massive fraud. His supporters threatened to form a parallel government in Kabul. Observers such as Lisa Curtis at the Heritage Foundation's Asia Studies Center admits a lot of suspicions do surround the outcome of the runoff vote.
We have to see some compromise with the situation and in living up to the agreement that Secretary Kerry brokered between the two leaders, which was essentially that whatever the results were from the recount, there would be a unity government in which the loser would basically serve as a chief executive. Both leaders need to see that if one of them tries to cheat the other one out of some kind of power in this unity government, that both stand to lose.
The Ghani team has made few public comments about details of their political negotiations, but the presidential candidate has maintained he's ready to make compromises that do not undermine the Afghan constitution. The United Nations hopes the audit of more than 8 million votes will be completed by September 10th, paving the way for war-torn Afghanistan's first democratic transfer of power. A peaceful political transition is seen critical ahead of the planned withdrawal of the bulk of U.S.-led international forces by end of this year. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Hong Kong police have used pepper spray to disperse pro-democracy demonstrators who heckled a senior Chinese official as he attempted to explain Beijing's decision to tightly control the nomination of candidates for the territory's chief executive. As Li Fei, deputy director of China's National People's Congress Standing Committee, began an address to Hong Kong lawmakers today, he was shouted down by pro-democracy legislators and activists.
The Beijing regime tried to devastate what they have promised for the Hong Kong people, one country, two systems. I think universal suffrage means there should be no censorship on the candidates on any election.
Li continued his speech after police forced the protesters out of the venue. He said, "We all know to occupy Central is illegal. Countless historical examples and real-life experiences from China's history and abroad tell us that if we bend down to the radical and illegal movements triggered by some people, it will only lead to more illegal movements at a greater scale. Therefore, when the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress made its decision, it comprehensively considered the situation and with the aim to protect the rule of law and safeguard Hong Kong's long-term stability, decisively formulated its policy." China's powerful Standing Committee ruled Sunday that candidates to become Hong Kong's next leader must receive a majority vote from a broadly representative nominating committee that opponents say will be stacked with pro-Beijing members. That ruling makes it unlikely that any opposition candidates will get on the ballot for the 2017 election. Hundreds of pro-democracy supporters later rallied in a Hong Kong park outside the territory's legislature, calling Beijing's pre-screening of candidates fake democracy. The activists have vowed to shut down the territory's central business district following China's decision. The United Nations is calling for the international community to help protect Iraq's minorities against persecution by militants from the Islamic State group. UN officials say the group's widespread and systematic atrocities against ethnic and religious minorities are crimes against humanity. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from an emergency session of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva.
One-third of the UN Council's 44 member states must request a special session for it to be held. In this case, two-thirds of the members voted for the emergency debate on the situation in Iraq, indicating the depth of revulsion and concern evoked by the abuse being committed by the Islamist extremists, also known as ISIL. The United Nations says at least 850,000 people have fled from the Islamic State onslaught to Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. To highlight the dangers, the world body notes 180,000 Christians, Yazidis, and other ethnic and religious minorities in fear of their lives fled there on one day. UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights Flavia Panzieri describes in painful detail the many violations being carried out by the militants, including targeted killings, forced conversions, abductions, slavery, sexual and physical abuse, and torture. She accuses the Islamists of ruthlessly carrying out what may amount to ethnic and religious cleansing in areas under their control. Panzieri says the effect of the conflict on the children of Iraq is catastrophic. She says many have been subject to physical and sexual abuse and forced by militants to join the fighting. She says these children will be scarred for life.
Families have reported forced recruitment by ISIL of boys as young as 15. Some of these boys who subsequently managed to escape told their families that they had been positioned on front lines during military operation to shield ISIL fighters. Others said that they had been forced to donate blood for treatment of injured fighters. Child soldiers have been posted at illegal checkpoints set up by ISIL and also by other armed groups operating in Baghdad and other areas.
UN official Shaloka Bayani says Islamic State is also attacking structures of cultural or religious significance. He says the group is trying to erase thousands of years of cultural and religious heritage by bulldozing or blowing up mosques, shrines, and other places of worship. Bayani also expresses concern about reports of human rights violations being committed by Iraqi security forces that he says may amount to war crimes.
Information received also alleges that the Iraq security forces have also been involved in severe grave violations of the right to life in the context of the recent events, including shelling of civilian areas, causing multiple deaths and injury, and the killing of detainees. All actors must abide by international law and must be held accountable for the crimes committed.
UN officials say anyone guilty of crimes against humanity or war crimes must be held accountable. A resolution before the UN Rights Council calls upon the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to urgently dispatch a mission to investigate alleged violations and abuses of international human rights law committed by the Islamic State and other terrorist groups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Three U.S. citizens being held prisoners in North Korea have been allowed to hold short interviews with an American television network, CNN. The CNN crew was on a government tour today when authorities suddenly loaded them into a van and drove them to a secret location for the surprise interviews. CNN says Kenneth Bay, Matthew Miller, and Jeffrey Fowle were each given 5 minutes to speak with reporter Will Ripley. Bay, who is serving a 15-year sentence, said he works 8 hours a day, 6 days a week at a labor camp and is being treated humanely. During his interview, Miller pleaded for help from the U.S. government. He has not yet been tried and will not learn the charges against him until his trial. And Fowle, an American tourist detained for breaking an unspecified law, said he has no complaints about his treatment. CNN did not indicate whether the three appeared to be coached on what to say. Well, you might have seen a tandem bike or even ridden one yourself. The two-seaters are becoming more popular among blind people. In many U.S. cities and elsewhere around the world, the blind are buying tandems and then recruiting sighted partners to get them on the road. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel meets up with a cycling club that accommodates blind bikers in the Washington suburbs.
Bonnie O'Day and her husband Bob Hart have caught a cab to the house on a quiet tree-lined street where the Tuesday night tandems are meeting. Bonnie has been legally blind since childhood. Bob was blinded by a progressive eye disease and walks with a white cane. Mark Mulligan pulls up with their bike locked into a rack on top of his car.
Okay, this is going to come pivoting out, so.
Mulligan carefully unloads the 3.2-meter-long three-seater to accommodate the couple and himself.
Is there something I have to be careful not
to there's touch? A camera right here, right there. I'm on, so I can lean it towards you.
On the other riding team, Jim Durham suffers from hearing loss. He adjusts a two-way radio headset so he can better hear his partner, Margaret Zelenska, who's blind.
Is this going to work?
Well, you know.
We'll try it. Find out.
Go around with it until it works.
Can you hear me?
Durham has carefully mapped out the route, one the five riders are familiar with.
So we got great weather. We go down Fort Williams, cross Duke Street, take Wheeler Avenue to the Holmes Run Trail. We're going to stop for stop signs, going to make sure.
The bikes pick up speed as they move downhill out of the neighborhood. As they approach city streets, they're careful to obey traffic lights and stop signs. They turn onto a bike trail that leads them into a park along the Potomac River. In tandem language, Mulligan is team captain. His job is to make sure there are no surprises for the blind riders that sit behind him. They're called stokers.
So you're supposed to tell them what's coming up, what's going on. The difference is learning to actually describe what we're doing. I call it the cruise director. You're trying to describe the sights as you're going on.
After dozens of tandem rides, the three work together like a well-oiled machine, acutely aware of one another and their surroundings. Hart says the ride is like a choreographed dance.
It just feels great when you've got some speed going and you're going around some curves and you're all in sync. It's really a great feeling. And, you know, you get that breeze, you get a little wind chill, and it cools you right off, and it's just a lot of fun.
How about you, Bob?
I get to be out in nature doing something faster than walking, which is really good. And as I go by things, I get to smell them. I get to experience the wind in my face and the smell of the flowers and a bakery if you happen to go by one.
Like we did today.
Like we did today.
Nearly 3 hours later, the bikers head down the home stretch, tired, hungry, but happy. Just like any cyclist who's just ridden 40 kilometers, says O'Day.
You know, we're not unique in any way. There are a lot of blind people who ride tandems. And of course, when we're riding, the people who are around us don't know that we're vision impaired. So we're just out there doing the regular thing, just like everybody else. And I think that's good.
The teams pull into the driveway where they started their ride. Hart and O'Day dismount and give each other a hug, buoyed by a sense of confidence and camaraderie that they carry back into their daily lives. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Fun.
Hey, Mark, give me five.
Sounds like they're having fun there. Well, Americans are celebrating Labor Day, a national holiday honoring the contributions of workers. The holiday has also come to mark the unofficial end of summer here in the United States. U.S. President Barack Obama is set to deliver a Labor Day speech in Wisconsin, where he's expected to draw attention to the economic advances, while also calling for a federal increase in the minimum wage, a top issue for Democrats. Mr. Obama has asked Congress to raise the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10 an hour. Well, thanks very much for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.